All right. Welcome, everyone. Great, sounds working so far, so good. Welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. This is a quote from the Stanford Philosophy Department website. Philosophy embraces difficult questions and investigates fundamental concepts. Some are abstract and deal with the nature of truth, justice, value. We're going to be talking about justice and value tonight, aren't we, Charlie?
Yes.
We are. The nature of truth, justice, value, and knowledge. Others are more concrete. Philosophy examines the efforts of past thinkers and cultivates the capacity to reason about our own thinking, to challenge our own thinking. The discipline encourages clarity of thought and careful analysis of arguments. So one of the ARC organization's goals is to encourage this mindset leading to, we hope, an enriched life for everyone that comes. Good evening, I'm Rob Olson. I want to thank everybody for coming out tonight. The Dallas Philosophers Forum is a non-for-profit organization formed in 1978. A few of us were around back in 1978. The board members are all volunteer. We're all volunteer organization. We meet on the second and the fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. So do we have any first-time visitors? Ah, okay, so how did you guys hear about us? Okay, some of your, okay, one of your friends, okay, good. Well, how about you guys, you folks?
Just an online search.
Okay.
Lecture series.
Lecture series and philosophy, or just lecture series Dallas?
Going in general, lecture series Dallas.
Okay, this one popped up then. We'll be on the first page, I hope.
First page.
Whoa, good job, Ken. Good job, Ken. It's our website, web manager.
It just happened.
Anybody else? Okay. Okay, through Daniel. Okay, great. Great. Daniel's going to be speaking in about 4 weeks, I think. So anyway, welcome, everyone. Really glad that you're here. If you haven't paid already, please do so immediately after the lecture. Skip is our filling in for David Drum, and so Skip is our treasurer this evening. So you can pay him right now, or you can pay him right after the meeting. It's $5, after the lecture, it's $5 and $2 if you're a student. And then if you want to become a subscriber, the cost is $35 for 6 months. Also want to remind everybody to pay your bill, take care of your wait staff. Everybody, every once in a while someone forgets, and then Dallas Philosophers Forum is stuck with the tab. So please make sure you pay after the meal, and please be generous with your wait staff. Anyway, those are sort of the housekeeping items. In addition, we have a website that has much of the same information, www.philosophersforum.org. You can sign up for our email list on our website, and then please, if you enjoy it, please feel free to forward that link to others, or your family and friends know about the Dallas Philosophers Forum. You can also sign up to get updates on meetings via the www.meetup.com, Dallas Philosophers Forum /members. Okay, so our speaker tonight will present for about 45 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up for questions. And on your question, please try and keep it to a short statement or two, and then get to the question. And last, please turn off your cell phones and put them on vibrate mode at this time. So we're very privileged to have Dr. Charles Barker with us tonight. Charles Barker, MD, and MTS is the founder of Compassionate Dallas-Fort Worth, a non-profit organization that promotes the Charter for Compassion. You're going to hear about this. The value of compassion, the compassion action of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, with the golden rule as its core operating principle. Dr. Barker is currently president of Compassionate DFW and moderator of the board of directors, a board representing all 12 sectors of the International Charter. It encourages the coordination according to the Compassionate Cities campaign, so he works closely with cities throughout the United States. He's also the current chair of board of trustees of the International Charter for Compassion. Locally, he chairs the leadership steering committee of the Richardson Interfaith Alliance. His background and experiences are in the field of medicine, with emphasis in preventive medicine and biomedical ethics. He facilitates medical school ethics sessions at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center as well. He was also in private medical practice for 15 years and served 20 years in the U.S. Navy working in the field of medicine. He completed a Master's of Theological Studies in 2014 at SMU, Perkins School of Theology, so he's a true Renaissance man. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Charles Barker.
Thanks, Rob. And first and foremost, I want to thank you for the opportunity to come here and talk about something that I'm obviously really compassionate about. As Rob said, my background and education, training, and experience have been in the field of medicine. For the first 15 years of my career, it was in family medicine, cradle to the grave, ambulatory to the intensive care unit, taking care of a lot of patients. And during those 15 years, saw and dealt with and was privileged to work with individuals, my patients, who were on the death and dying road, and which was very difficult for them, and to witness that, to be a part of that, to come up alongside that, and do it, what I would say, well. Requires compassion. You don't really talk about it necessarily. You don't say, well, I'm going to be a compassionate doctor. There's something inside of you, a core value that says, this is the right thing to do. And if you are a family doc, even more so. And I felt that way. And for 15 years, dealt with this. And I came to a point in my career where the idea of furthering work in ethics became primary. And so I left South Georgia and actually entered law school thinking law would be a good skill to have and going into a larger field of medical ethics, which at that time was really a budding field. It had not really developed to where it is even today. So I left, went to Emory University again, and actually entered law school over Georgia State, because I could work during the day and go to school at night. Well, this was 1990, and if you all remember what happened in 1990, Saddam Hussein raised his ugly head, and so I found myself as a Navy reservist being called up to go with the Marines to Desert Shield Storm, went all the way to Kuwait City with them, came back, and the law school said, we want you to come back, but you got to repeat the entire semester all over again, contracts and everything, and I had the opportunity to stay in the Navy and go into the Aerospace Medical Residency Program, get a master's in preventive medicine, and actually work in the field of aerospace medicine for 20 years, the last six of which was really in more administrative, XO, CO, hospital, and this sort of thing. So during all of this period of time, though, working with leadership in the Navy and realizing that the way we do business, my way, the highway, is really not the optimal way to do it. So really instituted a servant leadership, if you're familiar with Greenleaf's work with AT&T, the mid-level professional development. He developed a whole program of servant leadership. And that's what we instituted in several of the commands that I was in. Part of that is this idea, this core value of compassion. So my whole life, really, my whole career life, which has been long, as you can see, relatively speaking, this value of compassion was a practical thing.
Well, that's not what I
want to
do.
Okay, so the core value of compassion, very, very essential. who I was and the work that I wanted to do in the future. So, when I thank you, appreciate it. Medically, I call that the creeping crud. So, compassion philosophically, I think, is the value of the 21st century. I think it's also a practical value for the 21st century. But I would even go so far as to say it is the value of the third millennium CE. because all you have to do is look around and see what's going on in our own country and in the world in general. Just turn on the TV and you know what's going on. So why compassion? Warm, fuzzy sort of thing, but I'm here to tell you it's not necessarily warm and fuzzy. And so here is probably the main reason I would say, and if this thing works. Nope. All right, so I'm going to need to...
Okay. The principle of compassion lies at the heart of all religious, ethical, and spiritual traditions.
Kindness always invites you to listen very closely to be treated ourselves.
Compassion compels us to work tirelessly to alleviate the suffering of our fellow creatures.
To affirm ourselves to the center of our world and put some other there.
To honor the inviolable sanctity of every single human being.
Treating everybody without exception.
With absolute justice, equity, and respect.
It is also necessary, in both public and private life, to refrain consistently and empathically from inflicting pain.
To just speak violently out of spite, chauvinism, or self-interest.
To impoverish, exploit, or deny basic rights to anybody.
And to incite hatred by denigrating others, even our enemies.
Is a denial of our common humanity.
We acknowledge that we have failed to live compassionately.
And that some have even increased the sum of human misery in the name of religion.
We therefore call upon all men and women
to restore compassion
to the center of morality and religion,
to return to the ancient principle
that any interpretation of scripture
that feeds violence, hatred,
or sin
is illegitimate.
To ensure that youth are given accurate and respectful information
about other traditions, religions, and cultures,
to encourage a positive appreciation
of cultural and religious diversity,
to cultivate
an informed empathy with the suffering of all human beings,
even those
regarded as enemies.
We urgently need to make compassion a clear, luminous, and dynamic force in our polarized world,
rooted in a principled determination to transcend selfishness.
Compassion can break down political, dogmatic, ideological, and religious boundaries.
Born of our deep interdependence, compassion is essential for human relationships and to a fulfilled humanity.
It is the path to enlightenment and indispensable in the creation of a just economy and a peaceful global community.
And I'm not going to show the credits there, because I really want the message of what is said in that video to really resonate and to receive it as knowledge. And that's what it is right now, because it's only with critical insight and embodiment of what they're talking about in this that our mindset and society's mindset in general will change from one of self-centeredness to really one of other-centeredness, which is the whole goal. There's a whole movement going on, and of course, you could tell from that this is really going to be an easy thing to do, right? To implement this throughout the U.S. right now and the rest of the world. Anything but. And I think that to go deeper into the reason why compassion is the value of this century and the millennium, I think we have to go back into our evolution, all the way back, if you want to, if you prefer, and we can talk about this, all the way to the Big Bang, all the way back to when the first molecules and atoms came together, and several billions and millions of years later, biosphere is developed, and we human beings crop up as an aware species about 60,000, 80,000, 100,000 years ago, give or take. And so what I'd like to do is just walk through the evolution of ourselves, where we came from, where we've been, and where we think we are today. And to do this, what I'd like for us to do is to actually embrace a story, actually a book, that my friend Garth Jameson, who's a philosopher, he's a paleontologist as well, and teaches at the University of Nevada. He has put together a whole series of volumes of books, and one of them is Phaethon, a story for our mythic moment. And he talks about five moments of awareness in our human history. I was very impressed, and this what you're going to see is actually from an appendix of this very well illustrated book on this myth of Phaethon. And I don't know how many of you know the myth of Phaethon, but we'll talk about that in just a minute. This is the myth. So Phaethon, the son of Apollo, the sun god, and his mom says one day, "Son, you know your dad is, you know, the god of the sun." And he says, "Oh, really?" And she says, "Yes, and you can go and find out. You can go ask him." So Phaethon goes and says, "You know, I'm your son." He says, "Yes, you're my son, and I'll give you anything that you want." And so what does he do? He's a brash, arrogant young man who's, you know, got the world in the palms of his hand. And so he says, "I would like to drive the chariot across and carry the sun across the sky." And so Apollo says, "No, I don't think you really want to do that, son." And he says, "Yeah, I think I do." And so he promised him, so he let him take the chariot. And so what happened? Being brash and young and not really knowing how to handle, not having the wisdom or the experience to be able to do that, he gets in the chariot and with great, you know, with great strider and confidence, he starts the chariot and the horses across and carrying the sun across the sky. And of course what happens is he doesn't know how to handle the horses nor the chariot. So it goes near the earth and scorches the earth and it comes up and parts of the earth freezes. And Apollo sees that this is going to be catastrophic and he says, "I have to stop this." So he turns. So what happens in the end is that he turns the chariot with the sun in it over and Phaethon falls out and falls to the earth and dies. And so Garth Jamerson took this myth and applied it throughout our evolutionary history as humans. And so this is, and what he did was he actually took a well-known Joseph Campbell's myth and took the four essential aspects that Joseph Campbell talked about when he talked about myths. One, the religious aspect of a myth, the social aspects of a myth, the cosmological aspects, and then the psychological aspects. And what he did, what Garth did, was apply these to each of our evolutionary phases that we accept as, you know, these are pretty good chunks of time in which we evolve. The first being the Paleolithic stage, a stage of tribalism aspects, the numinous off or before the mystery. Things were sacred, didn't really understand them. Thunder and lightning, the weather changes, and there has to be something that's causing this, and so they grab hold of their animism and naturism. These things, when we were not as aware of ourselves as we are today, we looked at them and said, "Well, this must be the reason," and therefore, you know, we began to worship in those particular areas. Primarily tribal, sociologically, cosmologically, dominion of myth, giving a sense of where we came from, why we're here, and where we were going. Very unconscious at the time. Ritual, integrating the individual with the larger whole. And one of the things that he, if you'll look over here at this circle, this is the universe, and here is the individual within it, totally integrated, not really being aware that there was any difference between the person and the rest of the cosmic reality. And you can see the individual, you can't really see that very well here, but it's a dashed line indicating the individual really just being an integral part of that in which he existed, as described right here. Little or no sense of individuality, no differentiation between self and the other, as represented by the dotted line I just mentioned. So then we move, leap forward to the Axial Age, in which there's the development of major world religions. They're all pretty familiar. Confucianism before that, Buddhism, and of course we've got the Greeks with the various gods and goddesses and the emergence of the establishment of the Hebrew religion and all this around 500-700 BCE. Sociologically, the emergence of empire out of tribes Greek Empire, the Ptolemaic system of Earth sense being the center of the universe, and the emergence of our individual ego, beginning to an appreciation of our individuality. And graphically, within this cosmic realm, we see the individual with a little more definite line here, where it's described as, even though the universe is still sacred with its gods and goddesses, the emergence is still frail of the individual. And yet we did have, obviously, philosophers and spiritual leaders that began to speak their mind, as God says, from poetic barks to prophetic visionaries. The third moment of awareness in our human evolution, the medieval worldview, which we're still, reeled from that particular evolutionary period of time. Here, religion was dominant, and ecclesial society, with its faith, was the society, integrated into political powers. The Christian religion probably wouldn't be what it is today if Constantine had not seen the cross in the clouds and won the battle, and therefore adopted Christianity as the religion of the empire. Cosmologically, Dante's version of Ptolemy, with Earth as the center, and this heaven, hell, and this heaven, earth, and hell, triple-layered universes, was the level of consciousness that we had in general at that time. And then psychologically, the emergence of the religious identity with its duality, exploring heaven and hell, spirit and matter, good and evil. And even today, we still tend to have this thinking, this duality of thinking. The universe is actually represented here, is cross-hatched, as seen as a place of heaven and hell, angels and demons, saints and sinners, good and evil, preserved through the church, the synagogue, the temple, and the mosque during that period. And then we move into the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, evolutionary process of learning using scientific method, the modern world view. You know, all the answers to man's problems are all, wrapped up in this particular modern world view, or at least until we go to the fourth and the fifth levels of awareness. And this is a dynamic process. I mean, it's not something that all of a sudden, you've got these defined periods, moments of awareness, where all of this is so well defined. I mean, there's this constant flow. There's this integrative philosophic movement where there's this, okay, we think there's something better, so we synthesize it, and then we find out, well, it's not so good after all, so then we have the antithesis coming up, and then we repeat the cycle in terms of integrative philosophy and thinking, as I'm sure many of you are more familiar with that than I am. So the universe, so we had the Newtonian system, discoveries of Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo. The universe is definitely less sacred at this point in time. And I'll just back up. Sociologically, empirical sensibility is moving towards democracy, a sense of individuality, and a sense of some universal movement towards universal education. Much of it really coming from the church itself, the Benedictine, a strong tradition of education. And then psychologically, increasing scientific inquiry and a skeptical attitude, which many of us have today as well. So the universe is really looked at, and this is just generalities only. The universe is cold and empty. It's devoid of meaning, all meaning, both good and evil. It resides in a growing sense of individuality, and its rights rise above the collective. I'm an individual, and my rights exceed the collective. And this is illustrated in this particular circle with the hatch mark, where the individual is still wrapped up in a lot of the medieval sociocultural milieu, and that wasn't easy. Even these gentlemen who broke the mold still clung to many of the medieval mindset realities. So the fourth period of awareness for fully human beings, as expressed by Gard, and I really appreciate this this model, this idea. Is it absolute? No, but it's a really good way of thinking, especially as we move towards this idea of values in this century and values as we move forward as human beings. So we have the postmodern worldview, the mid 20th century, the latter part of the 20th century, distrust in religious institutions, fundamentalism that's come out even before and continues even to this day. Sociologically, emergence of the other, the ethnic, gender, racial, religious diversity that we see. The quantum universe with deep uncertainty. Is it waveforms? Is it particles? Is it both? How about the Higgs field, the Bose particle, and how does all this fit together in this great scheme becoming more and more aware of? So cosmologically, universally, the individual becomes decentered. The sacred is stripped from reality. Individual still is the source of meaning. Facts are replaced by individual interpretations. You have your opinion, I have my opinion. You know, and I think mine's better than yours is, you know. Collective unconscious, but a growing sense of the spiritual in the material world and soul growth representing abiding hope. So out of this is coming a synthesis or sense of the spiritual in this material world that surrounds us and that we've embraced since the 1600s, embraced so dearly, you know, as if it's going to solve the problems of the world, solved plenty of problems, and it was a great synthesis. But it really didn't answer all of the questions that we as human beings need to know and understand. So then we'll go to this postmodern worldview. When I was in school of theology, the first semester, and I talked about this post worldview. And so as the professor, what exactly do you mean by post-postmodern worldview? And I think this captures a lot of what is meant when some people, Gard in particular, and others talk about where we are now and at our level of awareness as we move forward. Religiously, we are developing a mindset of mutual respect and support of all religious perspectives, and this is in general. I mean, we still have the fundamentalism, we still have the radicalism, but there is the movement, and I think that, you know, you talk about this mass effect, and I think that we are, I'm an optimist, obviously, I wouldn't be standing here, when I talk about the movement being one that I'm seeing more and more of this, and obviously, with me being in the interfaith world, I mean, I have as many good friends of other faiths as I have in my own faith, which I still very dearly embrace. But I also, because of this common values and common needs, and the fact that we're all human, and being able to stand back with some impartiality, and be able to look at these things and realize all of the interdependence that we have, all of these things, you can't help but come out with mutual respect and support of all religious perspectives based on shared values. Sociologically, there's recognition of this interdependence of the biosphere, and not just with life forms, but non-life forms, non-human forms, I mean, all of the creation as we witness it and as we experience it. The cosmic awareness of a living, and to me this is one of the more beautiful statements, an awareness of a living, lawful universe,
that can be trusted. When I think about the Higgs field, and I think about the boson particle, and I think about how things are created, there's this, even though, you know, you look at the vastness of the universe, and it can be scary, you know, think about that, yet the laws of the universe work. We would not be sitting in this room if they didn't. And so there is this level of trust that we can have in the universe and how it works, despite the fact that we suffer, we live, we die, and we have a real problem with facing death. There's no doubt about that. Now, psychologically, a deep sense of contemplative interbeing, emergence of a cosmic consciousness, and a deepening spiritual perception. There's this Japanese method of reflection and of contemplation called Nikan, and I'm sure some of you probably know about that. But the very definition of this Japanese word is inside work. It's the work inside of you. And so what we're seeing, I think, is more inside work in each of us as we move forward with a higher level of consciousness, a collective consciousness, and this this personal development within ourselves. Cosmic or universally, you see what looks like a really nice plaid, a tiny plaid here, and you don't even see the circle in here anymore. The individual becomes recentered and reconnected with this entire sphere of reality, and becomes re-enchanted with the sacred, with the facts that we think we know. The meanings of those facts and the values are discovered to be integrated within our human consciousness. So there's a growing trust in the cosmos, and the contemplative attitude is essential to a meaningful existence. I want to read something to you, and then we'll move on. But I can't help it. When I received this not too long ago, I was really, I thought, what does this have to do with compassion? And you'll see the connection here in just a few minutes. How many of you have, this was shared to me by a fellow philosoph, and a couple of us, of our group is in this room right now, and we all received this from one of our fellow philosophers who isn't here. It's Steve Jobs' last and final essay. Have you all read that? Everybody in here? Okay. Well, so many of you haven't, so I'm going to take a little bit of time to read it, because I think it has everything to do with me and you and where we are in our individual lives and our collective lives. I reached the pinnacle of success in the business world. In some others' eyes, my life, this is Steve Jobs' last final essay. I reached the pinnacle of success in the business world. In some others' eyes, my life is the epitome of success. However, aside from work, I have little joy. In the end, my wealth is only a fact of life that I am accustomed to. At this moment, lying on my bed and recalling my life, I realize that all the recognition and wealth that I took so much pride in have paled and become meaningless in the face of my death. You can employ someone to drive the car for you, make money for you. You cannot have someone bear your sickness for you. Material things lost can be found or replaced. But there's one thing that can never be found when it's lost, and that's life. Whichever stage of life you're in right now with time, you will face the day when the curtain comes down. Treasure love for your family, love for your spouse, love for your friends. Treat yourself well and cherish others. As we grow older and hopefully wiser, we realize that a $300 or a $30 watch both tell at the same time. You will realize that my mom always said, you can't only put on one pair of pants at a time. You will realize that your true inner happiness does not come from the material things of this world. Whether you fly first class or economy, if the plane goes down, you go down with it. Therefore, I hope you realize that when you have mates, buddies, and old friends, brothers and sisters, who you chat with, laugh with, talk with, have songs with, talk about north, south, east, west, and heaven and earth, that is true happiness, exclamation point. Don't educate your children to be rich. Educate them to be happy. And I would say, see, how about content? be content. So when they grow up, they will know the value of things and not the price. Eat your food as your medicine. Otherwise, you have to eat medicine as your food. The one who loves you will never leave you for another, because even if there are 100 reasons to give up, he or she will find a reason to hold on. There's a big difference between a human being and being human. Only a few really understand it. You are loved when you are born. You will be loved when you die. In between, you have to manage. The 6 best doctors in the world are sunlight, rest, exercise, diet, self-confidence, and family friends. Maintain them in all stages and enjoy a healthy life. I couldn't help but read between the lines of the love. You all know what Steve Jobs' personality was like when he was making his billions and putting all this wonderful technology that we enjoy today. And for that, we're deeply grateful to Steve. But you know, he had a really difficult life, and he was a difficult person to work with. And it doesn't have to be that way. And I think on his deathbed, he probably realized that. And how better and greater it could have been if he realized it earlier. So then you got to talk about how we raise our kids, how we raise each other, how we nurture each other, and how we relate to each other. And this brings me to the next slide. About 4 or 5 years ago, and a couple of the philosophers here are smiling because they remember it. You all know David Alcock, and I'm sure he would be pleased for me to mention his name. He had us over one evening, and he wanted to talk about values. What he did was he presented about 20, 25 values on a piece of paper, and he gave each one of us this piece of paper, and he said, I want you to list the 5 top values on this list that are meaningful to you. And so we did. And so he gave us an opportunity to talk about, okay, what are those 5 values and this sort of thing. And actually we started out with 10, and then we went to 5. And then it was dropped. Well, this was one of those evenings. The Philosophs is a group of about 8 or 9 of us men, guys. But this evening we had invited our spouses or girlfriends or whoever. So it was a mixed group. And so everybody had an opportunity to do this. So we got to the 5, and so we started, talking about other things philosophically. Then it dawned on me that, I'd like to know what the top value is of everybody in this room. And so I asked the question, hey, David, why don't we have everybody just give us the top value? And so the top value, unanimously, would you believe, among this whole group, was love. It was love. And so I think that you can't talk about compassion. And I'll be a little more in detail in another slide as we move along here a little faster. But I really appreciate Paul Tillich's, it's a really short read, it's a morality beyond. But he talks about the various kinds of love. In the English language we have one word, love, and it means so much, until it almost doesn't mean anything sometimes. Mother-in-law, she said, well, love is as love does. So love is not just a noun, it's also a verb. But Paul Tillich breaks them down. The Greeks did a whole lot better job than we have done, in describing the various kinds of love. So Paul Tillich goes through these, epithymia, which is libido, lustful, sexual life. And I put in parentheses here, invariance, because Jacques Monod talks about something that's very very real, and that is our survival, and that at the top of the list is reproduction, and is reproductive invariance in terms of who we are and what motivates us to move forward in life, or a big chunk of it anyway. And he calls that invariance in his Chance and Necessity. Paul Tillich talks about eros, the mystical, the self kind of love, philia, brotherly, sisterly love, and at the top of the list he talks about agape, which is at the top of the list, but it has potential problems. This is this self-transcendent love that goes beyond our love of self, our love of brother, sister. It goes beyond those kinds of love. But he talks about how these are dynamic, that there's, you don't express agape and not be expressing some of the other, at least at some level, epithymi, eros, and philia at the same time. Or if you're with your libido, lustful, sexual, you're also demonstrating or having some pieces, maybe just a small part of these others. So it's not a one or the other, it's all of them together, but in different pieces and at different levels of expression. And so he talks about, this is what he says that I think links what he talks about love to this value of compassion. There is, for example, the compassion element of philia and eros and agape. And there is the agape quality and genuine compassion. The fact important for dialogue among the different religious traditions is this agape or this transcendent love element that prevents participation in the other one from becoming a mere identification with him. Motivation, meaning unity and literally with libido and sexual, the actual physical union of human beings and of other life forms. So this agape element prevents the participation. The self-transcendent prevents or should prevent, and we know it doesn't in many instances. And we can talk about bell-shaped curves and conical commutations, permutations of human nature all night. But anyway, this is another one from becoming a mere identification. As compassion prevents agape from becoming a detached act of mere obedience to the law of love. That takes, I think, a little bit of thinking in terms of this transcendent love is so up there until it negates all of these other loves. And so he's saying, I think Tillich is arguing, that this agape love is modified by these other forms of love. When he gets to the point where it becomes a doctrine, a rule, something that commands rather than is internally motivated. So I say only with love and compassion, along with these other things, forgiveness, reconciliation, restoration, can there be true peace and healing in our world, and I think our survival depends on it. A look at these two values as being two sides of the same motivational coin when it comes to our actions, our compassion actions and our actions of love. So I'll look at compassion as a noun and a verb. And so what is compassion? There is a book that came out, oh gosh, it's hard to believe it's been 2 years, to 2017. Dr. James Doty, Stanford University, and others compiled and edited a compilation of all of the research studies that have been done over the last 40 years in compassion, empathy, kindness, and from the Oxford Handbook of Compassion Science, this definition sort of generally describes what's used in the scientific world. Compassion is the empathic awareness of suffering, the desire to relieve the suffering, and actually doing something about it. So, compassion, the question I would ask you all, and I did want this to be a participatory type of presentation, is compassion a matter of choice? If it is, why is it? And if it isn't a matter of choice, why is it not a matter of choice? And if yes to love and compassion, as one coin, we say yes to the coin, then what are the next steps? And folks, would you believe that is my last slide, and I'm not going to, it's an open question, and it's something that I want us to discern and talk about. Because I think that there is a worldwide movement going on right now that is trying to implement this thing called compassion in the world. And there's a lot going on that I'd be happy to share with you. But I think the first question is, how do you see compassion? And is it a matter of choice?
This. It was very nice to hear all the different things you have to say about it. What I is it on?
Yes. You're
what I'm at, I'm going to come to kind of ask a question to go with this. Is it a matter of choice? If it is, how do we learn it? Because you must be able to learn it if it's a matter of choice. And if it's not a matter of choice, does it have to be in the DNA or some other form of experience that maybe you had that affected
I think the research is suggested. I don't think there's any of the research that's been done up to this point that's so definitive that you can say this is the absolute truth. But I will say that we do know from science and from our studies that kindness, we are hardwired for kindness, there's no doubt. And that's just a survival thing. We're kind to somebody because we want them to be kind to us, that we don't want them to hurt us, and we want to survive, okay? We want to reproduce. So we're hardwired for that. We're also hardwired for this empathy, and that's part of kindness and putting yourself in someone else's shoes, seeing yourself there. And I think everybody here knows that you can only be so empathic. There's no way you're going to be 100% able to get in someone else's shoes. So, but to the degree that you try, attempt, which means you have to develop a relationship, then you can begin to understand the suffering that may be going on. But there are barriers to becoming, to taking that next step. Empathy is necessary for compassion, but it's not sufficient. You can be empathic, but because of various and sundry reasons, you don't really take the compassionate action. It costs too much, it's too much trouble, any number of barriers or reasons why you would not go ahead and fulfill the compassion. The question about can you learn compassion, yes, I think you can. There are a number of I call it a bookshelf full or a tool chest of educational compassion education and training tools, all the way from a book study like Karen Armstrong's 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life, if you're familiar with that one, all the way to comprehensive compassion training programs like Stanford's Compassion Cultivation Training. It's a 10-week, two-week course. Jack and I both took that back in October of 2014, and it's a powerful course. Emory University has developed a cognitive-based compassion training program, which is very similar to the Stanford program. There's another one that is very exciting. It's called Compassion Integrity Training out of Life University in Atlanta, Georgia. And it is also a 10-week, 2 hours per week training course. And the nice thing about that one is that you learn a series of four skills that lead to self-compassion, followed by 4 weeks, 2 hours per week of skills that lead you to compassion for others. And then what's so neat about this particular course of study is that the last two skills are skills in how to be compassionate and take compassionate action within systems. Whether we talk about family systems or whether we talk about big corporation systems, How do we work in those in a way that is compassionate, that does foster this mindset of otherness rather than self-centeredness? So there are some courses, and yes, I think that the whole movement, one of the first things, very involved in Charter for Compassion work, obviously, and when people affirm the charter or organizations affirm the charter, one of the first questions they ask is, okay, Doc, I've affirmed the charter, so what's next? You know, what do I do with this? And I, after 10 years of working with this, the first words out of my mouth
is you need to learn more about what this thing called compassion is. It's not a warm, fuzzy thing. It can be very, very, very good, very truthful, very beautiful. But sometimes part of this doing compassionate action is discerning what the best compassionate action is. And that's a big bill sometimes to fail, because sometimes it's saying no. Sometimes it means you use tough love, because sometimes it means, well, this is what I really think would be great. But what you realize when you really either think through it or you make some motions towards that direction, you realize this is not the most compassionate thing to do. And so you've got to have that discernment to be able to back away. And that requires, I think, education, training, and this this increasing awareness and consciousness of this thing called that. So,
back in the 90s, I was very optimistic that we were moving in the direction that you're talking about. We seem to be becoming a much less tribal world. We seem to be caring more about each other, caring more about the planet, caring more about our future. Frankly, I haven't seen very much to give me hope in the last 20 years. And just within the last week, the United States is somebody in the United States wants to cut the budget for health and human services, for State Department activities, for aid, and increase the military budget by, I don't know, 15% or something like that. That doesn't seem to be a very compassionate choice. What, can you give me some hope? Is there, in fact, some evidence that we are becoming more compassionate?
I think there's evidence. I think there is evidence. If you involve yourself in the work that, I mean, and we talk U.S., but I mean, I got a phone call last week from Haifa, and they want to become a compassionate city. And what does that mean? It means a first step. I mean, let's face it, the Middle East is a mess. It has been and will continue to be for some time to come. But it won't ever change if we say, be naysayers and say, well, it's never going to change. So you embrace something like this, and you take those steps. And you take a few steps, and you move back again, because, you know, you got a president that's elected that's, you know, totally an anathema to this kind of thing. And you have to, the hope is that there's enough people and enough consciousness, and we're at a point where we're not reptiles anymore, that we don't have to think like reptiles anymore, even though we've got that part of our brain still. But we've developed something that's much greater, and we should be able to cling to that and hang to it. And because, you know, it's kind of like the Buddha, or, you know, the Dalai Lama, you know, in the Buddhist mental way of thinking, is that our mind is like a blue sky. You don't see anything. It's just a beautiful blue sky. That's our natural state of mind. But we have all this stuff that comes through, and so the metaphor is the blue sky, and you've got these clouds coming across, and these clouds will come, and you don't, neither do you detach yourself from them, nor do you cling to them. You just sit back, you observe them, and they will pass away. You know, so I think that a lot of the naysaying stuff, I think so a lot of the negative stuff, will pass. I mean, I did mission work in Zaire back in the 80s with Mobutu. And he was the most, I mean, he was one of those tyrants, one of those dictators, one of those that just sapped the blood out of the, you know, out of the people. And my prayer was that he would change, that he would, you know, that he would get better. It never happened, but he passed away. And so I think that the hope of the future is that all of this negative stuff is going to pass away. We just have to stay the course. And we have to, you know, as they say, keep the faith, so to speak. So I don't know if that gives you any hope, because we deal with it every day. But, you know, you can only do a piece. You can only deal with a piece. Deal with that piece and don't try to solve the entire problems of the world. That's my philosophy.
Question back here, Charlie.
Yeah.
My question is, as we move toward the post-postmodern worldview, would you consider evangelism as an act of compassion, or is embracing other ideas?
The word evangelism, you know, can be, you know, it's been used in all different kinds of ways, and you can have a very negative connotation with evangelism, where I'm in your face. Okay, I'm in your face about it, and you know, you got to believe the way I believe, or else. Well, that's kind of fundamentalism. And I don't see things, I don't see that as being compassionate. I think that we need to understand where a person is coming from, or a group of people are coming from, and to understand that that's a culture, that's something that has been there probably for some time. And it may not be the most compassionate within itself, but I think your dealing with that group has to be one of impartiality, and like the sun shines on the good and the not so good and all this. Well, you know, you have to look at yourself metaphorically as sunshine, and you don't, you know, you that's the way you deal with things. And so you try to understand people from where they come from. And that means even your enemies, you know. I mean, the very first video you saw talked about even our enemies. And when we work with them as they seem to be working with us, then we're denying our humanity. So you gotta question your thoughts about people like Trump. You even gotta think about, well, you know, and if this came up just a few days ago about Hitler. I mean, people think he's an evil person. I don't necessarily think he was born evil, you know, but I think that circumstances and everything else led to a very terrible event in the life of humanity. A very terrible thing that should never, ever, ever happen again. So we can't forget that. And then this lady over here, I think, has her hand up.
I might be dragging you slightly off on a tangent, and if I do, I'm sorry. But when you were going through the five stages of awareness, it didn't. I couldn't help but think that the way the fifth stage is described, the post-postmodern stage, is strikingly similar to the way the Paleolithic, I guess it was Paleolithic stage, was described, where it was a re-enchanting of the world and a reintegration into the universe, whereas the first stage is described as perfectly integrated with the universe, no sense of individuality. And the fifth stage is described essentially the same way. Could you comment on
that? Yeah, I think, to me, the difference is the consciousness. I mean, we talked about levels of awareness. And I think the level of awareness, when we didn't even know we necessarily existed, I mean, we did, we had a sense of it, but it wasn't an understanding like we did because of the modern period, because of the science, because of everything that we become in our level of consciousness. So the level of consciousness and the development of our brain is such that it is very different. We are integrated. We're integrated because we know that we're so interdependent, but we recognize it.
May I ask a follow-up question? It'll be very fast. I didn't interpret your phases of evolution to be literal evolution. Did you mean it that way?
Well, no. I mean, I think okay. It's just
you
generally
said evolution of the brain.
Yeah, generally the evolution of and what we've witnessed, you know, through these different periods. I mean, the Axial Age, all of the various religious traditions that developed during that period of time. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a general conception.
Can you speak of being compassionate with yourself instead of shaming and knocking yourself down and yada, 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 and all that self-talk, you know?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you speak on that?
For the Western mind and the Western person is probably one of them. Let me just say, it's a lot more difficult for us Western people than it is for Eastern people to be able to have compassion for self. And I think it's because of the traditions that we came from. I mean, my own tradition, Presbyterian, Calvin, John Calvin. I mean, he was a wonderful person, and I mean, and understood a lot, but I don't agree with him on a whole lot of stuff, you know, that he instituted, and he was, our capitalistic society, and how we've gone into the Western world with that mindset of absolute individuality and not relating to others, it's very difficult for us to do that. But these four skills that I talked about in terms of self-compassion, yes, you can, with these skills of of resourcing, tracking, and mindful focusing, and other techniques, you can learn to be compassionate to yourself. And I think the science shows that if you're not compassionate to yourself, you really can't be compassionate to others. So you really need to do that inside work first. I mean, each one of us need to do that inside work first. So,
question here. So I was about to ask a similar question, so I'm going to sort of ask a follow-up question, maybe a little more, a little different context, but so some you know, you talked about some innate characteristics that we have, and I think we would all say we know some people whose innate characteristics are revengeful, hateful, violence. And so there is this thing about how, you know, what's kind of at the root of that, and it kind of, as we know, it gets down to self-love and self-compassion. So maybe you might want to comment a little bit about Alan Jinko's model, that starting with the self-compassion, one is able to have compassion for others.
Well, I think, again, Jack, I'm not sure exactly where to start with what you're asking, other than I always go back to what I believe is our human nature, which is very, very potential in terms of this potential for great goodness, this potential for great evil. And that we make choices along the way. We make choices, but also circumstances. And you look at all of the conditions prior to World War II and what happened in Germany. I mean, the conditions were ripe for someone like Hitler. And and the choices that were made, the tribalism, you know, that we witnessed during that period of time, and the empire building attitude and all. So I'm not sure, I don't think that touches exactly on what...
Well, I was wanting you to sort of, you kind of touched on it already in the CIT training and so forth, but in the Stanford model that you and I went through, it kind of starts with understanding and having
self... Well, you can describe it, because you went through the program.
Okay, so having self-compassion... And then you go through levels of extending that compassion beyond yourself, maybe to your immediate family, and then maybe to your community, some community that you're in, and then maybe to somebody you really don't like, and then ultimately to everyone.
Yeah.
So it's a step-by-step process that begins with having compassion for yourself, because I can do compassion acts. I can take, you know, I can do Meals on Wheels. But if I'm just going through the motions and I kind of burn myself out because I'm really not compassionate for myself, then it's not really the meaningful type of compassion that I could have.
Yeah, and I would say what Jack's describing is what I would call increasing circles of compassion. And I think that I would like to really hone in on what you're asking, and that is this critical initial circle that we need to develop. And it's those skills that are in CIT that I'm talking about that leads that inner circle to become strong before you go to that second circle, which is compassion to others, and then compassion to the world, compassion to enemies, and this sort of thing. So it is a progressive type of thing, but the training programs, you really need to focus on each one of those levels, and each one of them have some great skills and exercises and stuff like that that foster it and cultivate it.
Question here?
Yeah, thank you. So,
to the point about the fifth stage that you discussed, the religious aspect that you mentioned was something pertaining to an amalgam of other religious organizations based upon quote unquote shared values. Exactly how does such an amalgam differ from a religion, a shared religion? If you share the same values, then what exactly differentiates you religiously?
Well, I think
And then is this not an attempt to convert the entire population to said religion?
Okay, there's an exercise that we use in compassion cultivation training.
I was trying to get his attention. Okay, you're a second.
Okay.
Lady has a question back there next.
Yeah, okay. So we know, having been in the interfaith world, that there are some common things, you know, that just like me, this Buddhist, just like me, this Muslim, just like me, this Baha'i, just like me, that you can say we have common needs and wants. And they can say, yeah, you know, I want my kids to grow up, I want them to have great education, this sort of thing. These values of compassion, every single religion and even secular spiritual groups embrace this value called compassion. If there's one value that we do have in common, it really is this particular value, I think. Do we have the same? What is it? What makes it different? I think what makes it different is just look at the denominations within the Christian tradition. Every one of them are different in some ways because of the person who fostered them, the person who established them, founded them. And so, I don't know if that's answering your question or not, but do we have a common religion? I would say yes. If religion is being grasped by something of ultimate concern, each one of us in all of these traditions are grasped by something of greater concern. And to that degree, we do share basically the same religion. Using that definition for religion, and I know everybody has different definitions of that. Paul Tillich's definition is religion is being grasped by something of greater, of ultimate concern, whatever that is.
Question here back.
My question is similar to some of the others, but with a slightly different spin. I've heard people say that animals show compassion to each other, that monkeys will even go get food and chew food and give it to a senior monkey who can't feed themselves. And I've heard that babies show some forms of compassion. And so what happens that goes away? But I've also heard that if your basic needs are not being met, you can't think of anything else except getting those needs met. So comment on the role of poverty in the world, in our country, as to the lack of compassion.
You know, you just put this tremendous weight. It's tremendous weight, and it's such a valid question and such an important question. And I don't even know where to start with that one, other than you're absolutely right. I think the only reason we had an axial age where because people had free time to be able to sit around and philosophize like we're doing here tonight. And out of that philosophizing, they came up with some really great ideas. But I don't think
those
that's
people had slaves.
Yeah, but, right, exactly. They had slaves. I mean, our country's founded
the Greeks,
on that.
The Greeks were.
Absolutely.
We have time for two more questions, and those two persons have already raised their hand. So,
I don't know if I answered your question or not. I mean, poverty is one of those things that a compassionate city, a compassionate community, isn't uncomfortable. And straight out of Karen Armstrong's mouth, and I think anybody who's in the movement says, you're going to be uncomfortable if you're a compassionate community, a compassionate person, because you're going to see the suffering. And when you see the suffering, you can't not do something. So what is that something? That requires the discernment. So.
Yeah, I appreciate what you said about humans having great potential for good and for evil. I think if you look at your evolution,
99.9% of that time was in the tribal period, and I think our mindset is still in the tribal them and us thing, and we have compassion for our group, but not for the outside group, and all of these civilizing religions have been trying to expand that to other groups as, you know, empires required it. But I think that we have to recognize that there's a lot of evil in people. That if I've been reading a book about DNA, and we're all descended from conquerors, people that conquered other people in nasty ways. And that's part of our human history. Steven Pinker, in his book about the blank slate, talks about there's a standard social science model, which anthropologists, sociologists like to, which is kind of a rosy scenario, but there's a big controversy about studying tribes like the Yanomamo in South America, that they're not really nice people, and that is not basic human nature, that they go raiding other tribes for women and other things, and that's one of their major lifestyles. So I think it's important to recognize that although we have neurons and things for empathy, at our core we have a lot of potential for evil, and that we need to recognize that and not ignore it.
Right, and you use the term empathy in a way that I would like to say something about, and that is, you can be empathic to evil. You can put yourself in their shoes and say, this is what I want to be. I mean, how many people put themselves in Hitler's shoes, who was the savior of the country and this sort of thing, and that's empathetic. And that is a kind of empathy. So you have to be real careful when you talk about
it. I think the best torturers are the people that know what really hurts. And that's a person that had no idea what hurts would not be a good torturer.
We're very low on time. We have time for two quick questions, two quick answers.
You've mentioned a whole bunch of training programs and other resources. Is there one place that to go to start looking for this stuff other than your brain?
Yes, sir. You can go to a couple of websites. I would say that the Charter for Compassion website, it's just www.charterforcompassion.org, and you'll see a link that goes to an educational institute, and under that is all kinds of educational opportunities. We locally are actually implementing the CIT program. There's only two facilitators right now, but our hope is that as we slowly train up a group of people, they're going to want to be facilitators as well, to take it to other groups, companies, organizations, and be able to really make a difference.
Okay, last question.
My question kind of coming from that gentleman question a little bit. It's really easy for us to be compassionate to our loved one, our friends, because we are wired for empathy and without nuance. But the hard thing is to be compassionate to other people. As our culture grow, our technology grow, we have more direct impact on other people. We can put a lot more people than we could before. And those, the before time, before the postmodernists, how do we teach people on a cultural, national level to be more compassionate so that we don't hurt each other?
Okay, yeah.
With our powers.
Good question. And we are partnering with a number of organizations throughout the world. I did want you to know them. There's 450 cities across the world. We're speaking to Haifa, speaking to Rome, Italy next week, who want to become, quote, compassionate cities. Uncomfortable cities, first thing they're going to want to know is, what do we do? And there are a lot of organizations out there who have developed syllabi for K-12 in our own nation. And so there are people that are visiting different school systems. There's a group going to be down in Houston, Texas next week to talk about implementing such a program in the kiddies, all the way up through high school and into universities. A number of university partners as well. So education training. That's the name of the game if we're going to be compassionate to others.
Thank you again, Dr. Walker. 2 weeks we'll have a presentation on free will versus determinism. That many of you are familiar with that argument, and we're going to have a great presentation on that in 2 weeks. Thanks again.
I have a choice there. Do I have to bring one?